It's the only time you have control of Bob McCowan. Let's go. Subscribe to Primetime Sports Podcast at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. Sportsnet 590 The Fan, on demand. He talks sports just like you do, only better. And he gets paid a lot more money to do it. Bob McCowan in Primetime Sports on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
All right, welcome back to Primetime Sports for Tuesday, June 30th. Jeff Blair and Arash Madani for your listening and viewing pleasure. Joined in our lovely Toronto studio by Luke Wilson, Seattle Seahawks tight end, wearing a Ramon shirt and a San Jose Sharks hat. And the first thing you said when you came in is, I'm not a San Jose Sharks fan. So what's up with the hat then?
You know what? It was a quick decision. I saw it at a store. I liked it. Matched some clothes I have. So I usually have an old school Ducks hat, but deep down, I'm a big Maple Leafs fan. So
for real?
Yeah. Oh,
do you get like... do you get to watch any puck in Seattle?
Not much.
Yeah,
not
I wouldn't think so.
No, but
so I guess the Mariners are the number two team there, right?
Yeah,
with the Sonics gone.
The Sounders, I think, have a decent following. But it's a pretty big football city, to be honest. So,
and what a time to be there!
Yeah, pretty exciting stuff going on the last couple of years.
So, how many times have you been asked about the play and the play call of Super Bowl 49?
Like, do you want me to give you like a number or just like... Well, I had to guess, honestly, somewhere between... This is not an exaggeration. Like, individuals, I bet somewhere between 5,000 and 6,000 times. That's not an exaggeration. I get asked it at least once a day.
Once a day?
At minimum. Like, if I go to an event, I might have to answer it 60, 70 times.
Wow.
So usually I'll just try and get a big group and like give one explanation and then go from there.
How many eye rolls of those 5,000 or 6,000?
5,000 to 6,000 might be a bit of a boost now that I say that. But it's up there.
Well, let's say it's 4,000.
It's an absurd number.
Yeah.
Like this weekend I've probably had it 75, 80 times.
Wow. But you know what's kind of cool about that? Because the way we watch sports now and the way we digest sports, I mean, I gotta tell you, there are a lot of football players, hockey players, baseball players. I'm a big Giancarlo Stanton fan. I don't have a signature. You know, what's your favorite Giancarlo Stanton player? I don't know, probably a 500-foot home run or something like that.
Yeah.
But you, my friend, you have a signature play.
The two pointer.
That's got a signature play.
That's right. I thought for a second you have a signature game. I was like, I don't know if I want this to be my signature game.
No.
Your signature game came a month before.
Exactly.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So. No, the play, I get, you know, it's funny, I get asked about the two-point conversion a lot as well. Not as much as the Super Bowl, but just because it was such a bizarre play. So, I mean, that one's a little more fun to explain than, you know.
So how long does it take you to get over that?
You know, I think everyone is a little different. For me, you know, it took a couple weeks. You know, I was pretty, and then you get out of the funk, but for me, it's just... You take the loss pretty hard, you know, when you're that, especially when you're that close and, you know, you spend your whole life and your whole season and everything revolves around, you know, executing and get to that point. And, you know, we didn't do it as a team. It was tough. It was a tough pill to swallow. And again, then to have to answer all the questions afterwards and all the speculation, it was not an easy thing. But I think what really helped was, you know, getting back this off season, getting back with the guys and, you know, starting OTAs playing football and kind of get the competitive juices flowing really, it starts to erase in your mind.
Are you the type of person that has a short memory when it comes to things like that? Because, I mean, everybody who plays sports, you're going to have plays where you've screwed up badly and maybe people don't even notice it, but you know deep down, like, I really butchered that. Do you have a short memory that way? Like, are you able to go, okay, next play is this?
You know, I think during a football game, you have to have that short memory. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that was something that I worked on from the mental side of it from my rookie to my second year. Was definitely kind of something, like you said, hey, good or bad, you know, because a lot of times, too, you make a great play and all of a sudden you're like, hey, man, like, you know, you kind of get a little arrogant. And next thing you know, you're not as focused as you should be. But for me, like stuff like that, down the road you kind of always remember after games. So I guess when you're in the midst of playing a football game, like you said, it's kind of on to the next play.
Mm-hmm.
Most important play is the next play.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, after the game when you're watching film, that's kind of when it's, you know, things – you start just – it's more constructive criticism than it is negativity. Like, hey, remember last game, you know, this step was too short or this route wasn't run correctly. Like, I got to make sure I'm on that. So, you know, you think about it to make sure that when you do it next, you're ready to go.
So how do you do that? How do you develop that, the on to the next play mentality, that mantra? I mean, they continue to throw it at you, right?
Yeah.
Bevel must be, you know, in your ear all the time telling you that. How does that become second nature to you, Luke?
You know, I think that it kind of carries into to really how you approach life, as odd as that sounds, but it's really kind of a way you live life. Like if you're dwelling on what someone said, or you see guys that are driving in traffic and, you know, they get their road rage and the next 15 minutes of their lives are upset. Again, I mean, what is it? It's kind of a perspective type thing, but for me, it's like, what is that going to do? So it obviously, if it can't help me on the football field, you know, thinking about a poor last play or a great last play or even the last play in general, I mean, no matter how much I think about it, what happened to happen, it's going to change. And I think that to kind of answer your question, as you grow older, you realize that, you know, it's such a game of focus and football, especially with 16 games and,
mm-hmm.
you know, most games are a one possession game. You need to be ready at all moments for really anything. And as you, I mean, you saw in our last two playoff games, some wild things could happen.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just kind of, again, with experience, you learn that, again, you can be having a terrible game or a great game, but one play can change everything. So
you mentioned focus. When you got the word that you were going to be the guy at tight end, that came right before the bye week, right? Zach Miller's his ankle was mangled. You went home. You had a few days. When you, from the mental standpoint, when you have that bye week to get your head right, that I'm going to be a focal point of this offense. I'm not just going to be a rotation guy. I'm not going to be the third. How did that change for you? And how did you prepare for becoming the guy at tight end, knowing Zach was going to be hurt?
To be honest, the only thing that really changed for me was rep count in practice. You know, I got a few extra reps. Because even before that, I mean, believe me, we meet a large amount of time throughout the week, and you need to be ready.
Yeah.
What happens if that were to happen midweek or mid game?
Mm-hmm.
So, and, you know, between all the film studies and, you know, our coaches and other players hold everybody accountable. So, again, it really wasn't that big of an ordeal. And just to kind of add on to that, when you're in practice, you know, playing against Cam Chancellor and Earl Thomas, you know, I mean, who are you going to see in a game that's going to come to practice and be more competitive or more intense or an all pro and make the kind of decisions and moves they make? So, again, I really felt comfortable kind of stepping in there. You know, I was on my X's and O's and I was ready to roll.
Luke Wilson of the Seattle Seahawks joins us in studio on Primetime Sports. Obviously, your team's going to go with the two tight end offense now. Jimmy Graham's there. How does that sit with you?
You know what? It's kind of neat. When I first found out that Jimmy was, you know, we traded for Jimmy, my initial thought is, you know, kind of going back to all the meeting time we have, is, you know, what is this guy going to be like in the locker room? You know, you get a big name guy like Jimmy, and he plays the same position as you. You know, you're going to spend a lot of time with him, whether you want to or not. And the cool thing is, you know, in the past 2-3 months that I've known him, he's been one of the hardest working, down to earth guys I've ever met in the NFL. So that's been something that I'm really looking forward to. You know, I feel like we got some pretty good chemistry, and you know, I'm excited because when Jimmy's on the field, and you got to account for him, and I think that's going to open up everybody else. And you look at our team with obviously Marshawn, who's the best back in the league, and you've got Jimmy with his athletic ability, and I mean Russell, he can literally do it all back there playing quarterback. And we've got a lot of great wide receivers. Next thing you know, we're in a two tight end set. We're both stretching the seam, or we're both hand down blocking, giving the ball to Marshawn. And again, we haven't even mentioned Jermaine Kearse and Doug Baldwin. It's gonna be hard to stop. So I'm looking forward to next season.
You mentioned Marshawn. The last couple of years, this persona that he does post game, not many of us know who this guy is. I think people in Toronto got a taste of it when he was with the Bills. He'd come through here.
Mm-hmm.
He was a completely different dude than publicly.
Was.
And he seemed pretty laid back then. He seemed pretty chill. What's he like now, Luke?
He, it's funny because he's one of those guys that is really, I mean, I don't want to say talkative, but he's pretty, you know, animated guy in the locker room.
He is, huh?
And he really is. Yeah. And it's, everybody loves him. You know, he's a great teammate. I mean, you see what he does on Sundays. And he's also, I think a lot of guys would say, extremely funny. So it's, and not in the sense of, like, he doesn't say anything, kind of like the media finds him funny. Again, that's kind of his ordeal, and we could care less as the teammates whether he does or doesn't talk to the media.
Why would you care?
Yeah. So, and he comes out on Sunday and, I mean, puts his body on the line, and during the week, he's a great teammate, supports guys on the team, and everybody loves him. So, again, when I hear, like, some guys are upset or this rumor about him, it's very odd, because I think if you got to know Marshawn and kind of know the person he is, a lot of people would have a different opinion of him.
So what can you tell us about him? You know, there are a lot of things we don't know, and not looking for state secrets here, but what kind of dude is he, man?
He's kind of, I don't know, now that you say that, he's just one of those, like, he's down-to-earth, funny, you know, very smart. That's another thing that a lot of people probably, very intellectual guy, like, knows what's going on, you know, knows his surroundings well. Again, as far as a football player goes, the cool thing about Marshawn is he's one of those guys where I bet any skill position on the field, you give him a couple weeks and he would start in the NFL. Like, mm-hmm. There's no doubt in my mind he could play wide receiver. And, I mean, great hands, runs good routes. Talk about a guy who's just dynamic and explosive on the football field. It's pretty neat to watch.
Let's hope he doesn't play tight end.
triple tight end set.
That's right.
You, if I'm not mistaken, you were going up to football camp in Newfoundland, were you not?
I was,
You were up there. Talk to us about that, because I found that really cool, the whole concept cool, but tell us a little bit about that.
So, you know, this offseason, I kind of, with some help with a group in Seattle, have my own little website here, and they sent me an email and said, hey, somebody wrote into the website and asked me if I was interested, and it was Coach Hughes. He's out in Newfoundland. It, mm-hmm. The camp was in St. John's. It was a day camp. And basically told me that they're trying to promote and start football out there. So, you know, I'd never been to the East Coast, and I thought, hey, sounds like a cool idea. But at the time, I really didn't look at the dates as well as I should have. Okay. Not that this would have swayed me, but I thought I'd be flying from Windsor to St. John's, but I happened to be in OTAs, so I had to fly from Seattle to St. John's, which, believe me, that was a bit of a dagger. But you know what? It was really a cool experience to me to go out there. Like I said, I've never been out that far. It was the end of April. There was snow when the plane landed. There was snow on the ground, which was a little surprising. But, you know, one of the things that I took from that camp was the kids worked hard. And, you know, they need to learn the game. It's not like Ontario kids or some of the BC kids. But, you know, they had some good athletes in their group. And you could tell, you know, down the road, I could see definitely them putting a pretty good squad together. But what was kind of neat was... it was the first kids camp I had been to that every kid after my little station was done and after the camp came up and thanked me for being there. So you want to talk about a polite group of kids that were, you know, pretty grateful. Again, I didn't do it for their thanks or anything like that, but I was like taken aback by, you know, how appreciative really the whole town was. So I got a lot of really speak highly of St. John's and Newfoundland, that whole area.
Football right now is kind of under siege by so many people talking about head injuries and all of that. You're a guy who grew up in Windsor playing minor football. What's your message to people about the head injuries and all of that from a minor football standpoint?
You know, I personally am not worried much about concussions as much as I think the bad one, I believe, is it's CTE or the chronic brain, because I believe that's something that you don't even know you have, and that from what I've been told down the road, there's not even magnetic imaging that can tell you you have it, which is pretty scary to me. But you know, I think that to get a full-blown concussion, you really have to be moving with a lot of force or hit with a lot of force. So I don't really think it's as dangerous, and I could be totally wrong, but for kids to play football as it is for professionals, because you're not getting these massive hits. Don't get me wrong, there's still obviously hard hits in high school, and I'm sure guys that are playing peewee football, there's been some hard licks. But, you know, if you stay away from the head, which, you know, most tacklers are now taught that, in my opinion, it's really, and again, obviously I'm biased, it's pretty safe. I mean, I think you'll see that in every sport, concussions exist. And again, I've been told that the highest concussion ratings is actually women's soccer.
Yeah.
So
the head in the ball. Very high.
You know, and you sit there and you think, but with the football helmet again, you really got to create a lot of force, which, I mean, it's tough to do, and you really got to take a direct shot or get some whiplash. So I think that as the game progresses, the equipment's getting better. You know, we're starting to do more precautionary stuff mm-hmm. with helmets and such that I think we're going to see in the near future. So I would, I really don't think that's a thing that should sway people away from playing football.
In a point of fact, if I'm not mistaken, the Seattle Seahawks and Pete Carroll, the system of tackling that he talks about
yes.
is actually used by the U.S. amateur football. So it's kind of the guideline, because Pete's very aware of that, isn't he? It's kind of the guidelines that amateur football in the U.S. uses now, if I'm not mistaken. There's a package that amateur coaches get.
I think there's two separate schools of thought, but our school of thought, and you know what's funny is we watch this film every week. You know, we have one of our assistant head coaches will come in there, puts together kind of a highlight film of us and around the league of, you know, form tackling and how to hit. And again, the way we teach it, and I think we've been the best tackling team in the NFL as far as missed tackling goes for quite a mm-hmm. bit now. And, you know, there's very little head-to-head contact. They actually kind of make a baseball reference with the strike zone. You know, you go above the knee to the bottom of the kind of the top of the chest. And, again, it's all kind of shoulder. And, you know, obviously it's extremely violent collisions, but it's really nothing, no head-to-head contact. Which, again, if it's done right, it should be safe.
You practice against what's been the best defense in football the last couple of years, Luke.
Yeah.
Legion of Boom, kind of piece by piece, is now going away. Guys are getting paid with other teams. Just lost your defensive coordinator to be the head coach in Atlanta. Is there any concern there about some of the pieces disappearing? You're shaking your head already.
No. To be honest, again, like losing guy or head D coordinator Dan Quinn is a loss.
Yeah, but it's all part of it.
And that's kind of what happens when you have a defense like they are and perform and are as great as they are. I mean, you're going to lose guys. And I think, like you said, we lost Maxwell. But the cool thing is, you know, we got Kerry Williams and Will Blackman, who are both tremendous players. Then on top of that, you know, Coach Richard, I know the guys love him, and he's been in that system. He's been under, you know, Dan Quinn last year and or the last 2 years. And I'm looking forward to see, you know, how he's going to take, you know, what's already a great defense and maybe put his spice on it. So, again, but as long as you have that core nucleus of guys, which we still do, you know, mm-hmm. you've got our D-line up front. You know, you Averill, Michael Bennett, Tony McDaniel, and then you've got Bobby Wagner and KJ and Bruce Irvin, you know, playing linebacker, and you still got Chancellor, Earl Thomas, and Sherman, and now we're plugging in a guy again.
Not could bad.
Be, yeah, it's going to be, it's very tough to play against, but it makes you better as a player.
Luke Wilson of the Seattle Seahawks in conversation with Rash Madani and Jeff Blair in studio. So Russell Wilson goes to the Texas Rangers. Spring training. You were a pretty good baseball player, good enough to be drafted, I believe. Anybody asked you whether you'd like to take a shot at baseball?
You know, I haven't been asked that in a while. I did. I was went down to extended spring with the Blue Jays, kind of going into my senior year of college. So I was not down there for very long.
And did you play it? Sorry, you played at Rice? You were two sport?
I was not. So I went there originally as a two sport guy. And played a little bit my first year.
Okay.
Kind of did inter squads, but to be honest, I was about 210 my freshman year at Rice. And a 6'5", 210 guy is not ideal for playing tight end. So right. I was getting, you know, kind of crushed in the weight room. So I was like, you know, I need to get my body ready to play next year for football. So went in, talked, and was like, hey, I was going to play summer ball that year and then go back and play baseball. And I did. I went and played summer ball in Houston in a little summer league that year. Kind of balanced it with summer school and working out with football. And that football season ended up tearing my labrum in my throwing shoulder and had surgery. So I kind of put baseball on the back burners. Right. Didn't really play until, you know, the Blue Jays gave me a call. And, you know, trained a little bit. Still had a pretty decent swing. So went down there. And, again, I really enjoyed it. But for me, I've always kind of enjoyed football. And that was kind of the dream for me.
It's kind of it's funny because one of the things we lament is the loss of the two-sport athlete. Yeah. A lot of times now kids are kind of forced to make a decision, grade 10, grade 11. They're forced to make a decision. How do you feel about that? Do you think it helps a guy? Like, did you feel that kind of having that other skill may have helped you in some ways with football?
I'll be honest. This is a bit of a sensitive subject
okay.
for me. I couldn't disagree more with individualizing kids in sports.
Okay. Amen.
Good for you.
I just think it's a terrible, terrible thing to do from a variety of different perspectives. One, I mean, most obvious is just burning kids out. You put a kid in, I mean, I hear kids now like, oh, eighth grade, I'm lifting weights, I'm doing this, I'm doing that. I'm like, you know, if I was in eighth grade, when I was in eighth grade, I didn't know I was doing it, but I was playing all these different sports. I was becoming athletic. Mm-hmm. You know, you get into these hockey or football or baseball, whatever it is, and you're going to play 6 years, all you do is, you know, it takes the fun out because it becomes like, hey, I'm doing this just so I can get a scholarship or play mm-hmm. here or play there. It's like, again, when you're 12, 13, 14 years old, that's not the point. And but two, you know, you look at an NFL locker room from my experience, and it's loaded not with the strongest guys in the world, which, don't get me wrong, there's a lot of very strong players in the NFL, but it's loaded with athletes. So
sure.
And to me, you know, you become athletic, like you said, by doing different things.
Mm-hmm.
And it's funny, but my kind of off-season program, I actually play a lot of squash. Because
mm-hmm.
I find, you know, it keeps the foot quick.
Right.
It's also competitive.
Mm-hmm.
So, again,
there's not much room with you out there in a squash court, is it?
You know, it's really not.
Plus, you're probably pretty good at it, yeah. which is...
You know, at first I was struggling.
You just own the tee, don't you?
Right, that's right. But, you know, that's kind of my thing was, and again, I could go on and mm-hmm. kind of, if you guys got any more specific questions, but I really, when I tell kids, I'm like, hey, when you're in 8th grade, 9th grade, 10th grade, the number one thing you should be doing is enjoying it, you know, because...
Did your parents stress that? Is that something that comes from your family, or is that just something you kind of...
That's just something, you know what, I never had any pressure from my parents to play or any sport. And now, you know, looking back on it, I did high school. I was playing football in high school, hockey on a club team. You know, I played hockey in high school some years. My grade 9 year, I was on the basketball team. And then I actually played soccer in grade 11. Was a track guy every year. One year did the hurdles. 1 year
mm-hmm.
through the shot put. And, you know, people always say, would always say, you know, if you focus in on one sport, you'd get a gold medal or you'd be unbelievable. And for me, it was like, you know, my goal was to play professional at some level. You know, I enjoyed going out and playing goalie on our soccer team, which I think we got fourth at offsets, side note. It was mm-hmm. pretty solid, right? We pulled a couple upsets late. But, you know, it was fun, and I met a variety of people, and to me, again, it kind of forced my body to do something different, and I felt like I became a better athlete because of it.
I love the voice you use, by the way, for all the experts telling
you know,
what to do.
That's,
yeah.
I don't know. I feel like that's funny, but a lot of people just, they kind of have these ideals, and it's what's tough is when you hear these people talk, they've never really been there, so it's like,
sure,
where are you getting it from?
So one guy who has been there.
Yeah.
Is a Windsor guy. His name's Joe Siddle. He's
yeah.
going to join us at 6 o'clock.
Nice.
Blue Jays color analyst.
Yep.
You and Joe go back.
We do. It's funny. I don't know if has he told you the story?
I don't think so.
So he
Tell
was...
Tell us and we'll okay. bring it up with
All
him
right.
at 6.
He better admit to this too. So it has to do... Last year I got a Christmas gift from Joe, and I'll tell you, it was a signed ball from Joe. So, and this is where it goes... Again, this has a little story behind it. But I've got two older brothers, and my dad was a big baseball player. He was a catcher in my hometown. You know, they won a bunch of Canadian championships back in the day. And we had this guy from Windsor, LaSalle area, that was playing for the Tigers, you know, a major league baseball player. And I was a pretty big sports kid. So my dad's like, and my dad had known Joe. So he's like, hey, we're going to see a doubleheader at, I think it was Tiger Stadium at the time.
Right.
So we cross the border there, and I'm all excited because I'm like, hey, and I've got my baseball, and so does my brothers. And I'm like, I'm going to meet a player from my hometown. The guy plays in the major leagues. Again, I was in awe of Joe Siddle. And in between games, we go down to kind of the ledge, and we're screaming his name. So he comes over. Me and my brothers are just going nuts. So he comes over, And he's, oh, hey, you know, my dad's name's Mike. Hey, Mike, like, thanks for coming out. You know, politest guy. And my dad's got my one brother in his left hand, my other brother in his right hand, and I'm kind of beside my brother in his right hand with about 30 other kids, like, asking for his autograph. So he's like, hey, I got to get rolling. I got to warm this guy up. He's like, okay. He's like, here, I'll sign your son's balls. So he signs my one brother's ball, my other brother's ball, and then bounces and just leaves. I remember.
Did you have a fit?
Oh my, a fit. That's an understatement. At the time, I might have been 6-7 years old.
Oh God.
I was bawling the whole way home, okay,
your poor dad.
Screaming in vain. I couldn't stand Joe Siddle at the moment, just crushing this guy. And you know what's funny is we have, so again, the end of the story is when I was 22, he finally gave me a Joe Siddle signed baseball.
Nice.
But what's funny about it is once in a while, and actually, and I, just because that story stuck with me and I told him this, we training camp, we invite fans in. And they're literally like, hey, you've got 7 minutes, and then you got to be, you know, it's next workout, next meeting.
Meetings,
so, but they'll send
right.
over, and especially the rookie, my rookie year, send over rookies. So rookie year, I'm over there, and they're like, hey, clock starts now. You got 7 minutes, or else you're going to be late. So go over there, and you know there's a couple thousand people. So you're signing as much as you can. People are shoving stuff in your face. And, you know, you try and get all the kids and that sort of thing, but they blow a horn, and they're like, all right, we got to go. So I turn around, and some kid just starts crying, like obnoxiously crying, and I literally took a step and it was like I had a flashback of me. So I was like,
Luke,
oh, I got you, buddy. He went back and signed his football or whatever it was, and I kind of thought of that moment again about 20 years later.
There is a father in the Pacific Northwest
right
who
now.
Is grateful
yeah.
that Joe Siddle didn't sign your baseball.
There you go.
See, and it's funny because I covered Joe when in part of his career with the Montreal Expos, and everybody's a good guy. Everybody's a good guy. I mean, Joe's just like the nicest guy on the planet.
Yeah.
He has been forever.
And
that would bug him. Bug the hell out of him.
And he went above and beyond. Again, at the time I was a kid, I didn't understand. Especially now, I definitely understand. He went above and beyond, came over, supposed to be doing something else, you know, talked to my dad, thanked us all. And again, I was kind of in a crowd of 30 kids, but in my 5 or 6 year old mind, or however old I was like, it was like Joe was talking to me, you know, but looking back on it, he would have had no idea. So again, it was definitely not his fault. But at the time, I was pretty devastated.
Awesome.
Do you still watch? Will you watch baseball? Like, are you a baseball fan still? Or
that's the one where I catch a lot of heat for. I'm actually a Yankees fan.
Ooh.
Yeah. So I do catch a lot of heat. And people, you know, they drop the bandwagon line on me, but I was a Lions fan in football growing
right.
up.
Yeah, so you're not a bandwagon guy.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
You're not a bandwagon guy. You're talking to two Vikings fans?
Yeah.
I mean, we're not quite Lions level, but there's a certain amount of pain
there,
isn't
it? Times are changing.
Teddy football.
That's good stuff.
Yeah. Listen, Luke, we're going to let you run. We appreciate you doing this so much. Show us that ring.
Yeah.
I want to get that is...
I'll just put it up. There we go.
That's pretty spectacular.
Yeah, kind of.
That might be the biggest ring. That and the Miami Marlins World Series ring 1 year is pretty huge. But
how fun, by the way, real quick, how fun is that night when the rings come out and they have the...
It was awesome. We had Kenny Mayne was our MC.
Awesome. Mm-hmm.
And he was hilarious. We had a little at the place. They did it, again, it was all done up. And I was like, oh, they're going to who's going to get the first ring? And they actually had it kind of hidden in a... table kind of decoration for everybody.
Okay.
So it was like slide this little box open and everyone had one, and all of a sudden, so we all got it at the same time. And you know, then afterwards they had Usher was in there, so it was like Usher performed for a while. It was a pretty surreal night. I was actually down there. We got one guest, so I didn't have any family members in town. So the head coach for the University of Windsor Lancers was in town checking out mini camp. So I was
kidding.
Joe DeMora. I was like, you want to come down and check the ring ceremony out? And he was like, oh, dude, I love that.
So you kidding me?
Yeah. It's funny. Everyone's showing up with like these dates. Joe was one of my coaches in high school, and everyone's showing up with these dates or like someone, you know, and they're like, Luke, who'd you bring? I'm like, oh, I got a high school coach here.
Listen, so, as I said, we really appreciate you joining us. Man, continued success, and hopefully you get a couple more rings.
Appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Again, thanks for, I know that you've been a pretty good friend to this station and as well, and we appreciate you doing this.
Yeah, thanks for having me, guys. Appreciate it.
Stay healthy, boss.
Yeah.
Luke Wilson. We'll be back with Chris Johnson when Primetime Sports continues on the Sportsnet Radio and Television Network.
This ain't like when you're at a game and sign up for a credit card just to get the prize and then you immediately cancel the credit card. Because there's no prize when you sign up for our radio shows at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand. Now more of what you want to hear on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Welcome back to Primetime Sports. Jeff Blair, Arash Madani. Cowan's going to be back on Monday, so relax.
And the Jackets are going to win the
and
cup.
And the Jackets
next year.
Are going to win the cup.
Jeez. Nationwide Boulevard Parade Route, here we come.
That is Arash Madani, the world's only Columbus Blue Jackets fan. The man to my left is Chris Johnson, the NHL Sports. Where did the Blue Jackets thing come from?
That's a long
story. It's a good story.
It's a good story, but it's a long
Doug McClain probably doesn't want to hear it again.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I'm not telling it.
All right.
No.
Suffice to say, you're a Blue Jackets fan. The Blue Jackets.
I don't watch a lot of their games, but I root for the Jackets. They're the everyman's team.
Well, they now have plucky.
Yeah.
They also now have Brandon Saad, the Blue Jackets, and the Blackhawks making a 4-player deal that includes a draft pick. Brandon Saad, Alex Broadhurst, Michael Pagliotta to Columbus, Artem Anisimov, Marco Dano, Jeremy Moore, and Corey Trop, a 2016 fourth-round pick, and a partridge in a pear tree going to the Chicago Blackhawks. Chris Johnson, what do you make of this transaction?
Well, certainly a lot to digest there, guys, and probably most notably just the biggest name in the trade. Brandon Saad getting dealt is not something I would have predicted more than an hour ago when Elliot and I really got on top of this and started chasing it. And, you know, what I think it is more than anything is Chicago, as we all know, has deep cap issues. As they went through the draft weekend and talked about Patrick Sharp and maybe some of their other players, they found they were going to get absolutely no value. They weren't getting much help from other teams, and they decided to sort of turn things a bit and put it in their favor. And when you throw Brandon Saad in there, obviously, you're going to get a better return.
Because by the end of the playoffs, I mean, I can remember a lot of people talking about how, well, Brandon Saad's got to be included now in that core, that Blackhawks core, right? He's the Taves, Kane. I mean, he's got to be part of that group. And I mean, I think you're right. I think their first choice was to try to peddle Sharp, but I'm looking at the players going back to Chicago, and I think we were talking about this off air. We're kind of in agreement that Dano's probably the guy, right? The 20-year-old center, because they really do need help up the middle in Chicago.
Well, there's not a team in the league that doesn't want a 20-year-old centerman.
Sure.
And, he did get a pretty brief stint, about a third of the season last year in Columbus, and scored more than half a point a game, which I think, given where he was, is encouraging. That's probably the prize, you're right, of this. But, this was, for the Blackhawks, a very real concern, of course, was, getting a offer sheet for Brandon Saad tomorrow because he was unsigned as an RFA. And in fact, unless I get some confirmation here that Columbus has a deal with him, that doesn't change for them, that they're facing the fact that if they don't get his signature on a contract by noon tomorrow, then another team can swoop in and sign him and either have them match or give up draft picks. But for a team in the cap trouble the Blackhawks were in, this is a desperation move, and I'm sure for them they shopped him around. This is the best they could get.
So we didn't know about Sharp's future. We didn't know about Bickle's future with the Blackhawks. Because there wasn't much value there at the draft, does that mean they're going to remain Blackhawks, or is Chicago willing to get 70 or 80 cents on the dollar on what they'd hope to get in return?
I think it's doubtful that Sharp in particular remains a Blackhawk. I mean, okay, Anything's possible, but from all indications there, the sides had kind of split up and been mentally preparing to move on, and Chicago's cap troubles still run deep. I think that this move allows them to be a bit more patient with Sharp. Mm-hmm. They don't have to trade him right away. I mean, you can go a little bit over the cap, 10% in the summer, but if Saad had been offer sheeted, I think it would have further weakened their position when trying to deal those guys, because everyone would know that they would have to trade them. And, you look back to last season, both Boston and Chicago were over the cap until the day before the season, and that's when you got those dueling New York Islanders trades, when Johnny Boychuk and Nick Leddy ended up as Islanders on really not much in return. And that's what happens when everyone knows you're over the cap, No one's going to come help you out, and you're going to get backed into a corner.
Chicago's gone through this before, of course. I mean, Jonathan Toews talked about this at the Stanley Cup parade. I mean, they've gone, and this is the nature of the salary cap, right? In some ways, the Blackhawks are the model organization, and they're so good that they're almost being penalized for being so good. How is this Blackhawks team now positioned for next season compared to the last time they had to gut the team and they ended up losing? But they lost Bufflin. I mean, they lost
in 2010. They lost everybody. Andrew Ladd,
right? Ladd, Bufflin, and
Versteeg, Brian Campbell,
right?
It was a big chunk. I mean, I think the one thing we know is that they know they can get through this again. I mean, I think that there isn't the fear there. There might have been even amongst the other players. And I'm of the belief that this is actually a positive thing in some ways for the Blackhawks. Maybe not trading Brandon Saad specifically, but having to regenerate your team, I think, has some positive benefits in terms of keeping the motivation in the room high. You don't overpay as many players. I mean, the other lesson, the other flip side of the salary cap is the Boston Bruins, or maybe even the LA Kings to a lesser degree. And when you win with certain players, everyone gets long-term deals, and you get stuck. And we've seen with the Bruins last weekend, they're kind of at a point in their roster, I think, where they feel stuck. And that's why you see Lucic get traded to L.A. The Dougie Hamilton situation is a little bit in a bubble because, you know, it seems that he wanted out of Boston. But but there's still a lot going on there with the Bruins, and I think some of their problems are self-made by how many players that they've basically had to give these long-term deals to. So in Chicago, they identified the two, you know, very specifically. I think we can include Duncan Keith quite safely in that group of three players that you know, I'd be shocked if they moved ever, basically. And everyone else is to varying degrees expendable. And Brandon Saad's a great player, but I'm sure they have confidence they can win without him.
What does this mean long-term for a guy like Brent Seabrook, if there is a long-term for him?
It could mean that that there's a little bit more room to think about keeping him longer term. You know, if he had been moved, I would have viewed that purely, again, as a cap casualty. Okay. And we were all projecting Brandon Saad being part of this team and getting a $5 or $6 million contract, you know, right now, heading into next season and likely a long-term one at that. And you know, that's good chunk of money that'll go the way to paying an extension for Brent Seabrook if that time comes. But, you know, it's hard to say if they can't move Sharp. I mean, you know, that kind of maybe complicates things still. But you know, I like this move because it's very rare today that the trades, you know, you find out and go, whoa.
Yeah.
That was one of those trades. I mean, that's some outside-the-box thinking, and it's going to be a good one for us in 3 or 4 years to kind of handicap how it went.
Courtesy of the Sportsnet stats department, Brandon Saad is the 13th Blackhawks player since 2010 to be traded or sign elsewhere after winning a Stanley Cup in Chicago. You mentioned Dougie Hamilton. So, yeah, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong. I think he signed for $250 more a year in Calgary than he would have made if he signed the sheet in
Boston. On the last contract offer from the Bruins.
Yeah. What went sour there with Hamilton and the Bruins? Do you know, Chris?
I don't know the full extent of it, but, you know, I've been led to believe that he just didn't like the fit there. He just didn't feel totally comfortable with the organization, perhaps some of his teammates. You know, I just was left with the impression he was open to something new. I don't think – he certainly didn't ask for a trade, but he was taking a hard line in negotiations. And, you know, ultimately the Bruins looked at it and they knew. I mean, last weekend – this actually might be the year we get a little bit of an exception to this, but draft weekend is kind of like trade deadline day in the NHL. That's the time if you're going to make a deal, if you're going to be bold, if you're going to try to really reimagine your team, that's the time to do it. I think because of some circumstances we can talk about down the road here, I think we'll see it seep into this week more than it has in the past. But, you know, the Bruins looked at it. They were having trouble getting him signed, and I think the writing was on the wall, and they decided to strike at the draft and obviously got, you know, three fairly high draft picks for him, and that was it. And, you know, in Dougie Hamilton's case, he was more than happy to go to Calgary where, look, that's a really good young team. He fits in, I think, perfectly with what they're doing there, and it wasn't very hard, as it turns out, for his agent and you know, Brad Treliving to make a deal. It really took 4 days, and two of those 4 days, everyone was busy with other things. So, I mean, it was an easy negotiation once you were somewhere more comfortable.
In conversation with Chris Johnson on Primetime Sports. He'll be part of the cast of bazillions tomorrow. He'll be working during the free agent
frenzy. We're going to be busy, though. I know that we like to scoff, and everyone's saying this is a weak free agent class. I think there's better players than people think.
And I was going to ask, where's the value in this? Because I think you're right, but where do you see the value in this free agent class in particular?
Well, the blue line for sure. I mean, I think the Cody Franzen and Andre Sequeira, while not the biggest names, I think that those guys have the potential to be Anton Stralman of last year, mm-hmm. where, you know, Stralman was available to 30 teams on July 1st. He, you know, wasn't a big sexy name, I don't think, you know, probably the way we were selling it on the show last year, I don't recall. But, you know, I just spent six mm-hmm. weeks around the Lightning in the playoffs. And, you know, John Cooper, the Lightning coach, would tell you that Stralman was his MVP of that playoff run. You know, that's sort of what he was saying, you know, not necessarily at the dais, but quietly, that he was the absolute key to getting more out of Victor Hedman, to giving them the opportunity to move the puck up the ice better, to get it to their forwards. I mean, he was, in the span of a year, he became an integral part of that team. And he was a July 1st pickup. I think that there are guys tomorrow we'll say the same about. I mean, the flip side is you're going to have some David Clarkson contracts every year. I mean, there's mm-hmm. maybe not quite to that degree, but you're going to have some guys who get massively overpaid, perhaps on long-term deals, and perhaps in 2 years' time they'll be getting them bought out, as we saw a few guys get this week. I mean, that's kind of the line, I guess, GMs are trying to walk. But I think we're going to see more trades tomorrow. I still think an offer sheet is possible, although with Saad gone, I would have put him as the number one candidate for one. And again, I'm assuming the Jackets are going to sign him, but no guarantee there. And I do think there's going to be a lot of movement and action tomorrow.
This may be an unfair question, but who's the candidate for the David Clarkson Award this year in this free agent class?
The name or the team?
The name.
Matt Bolesky probably would be there because he's had one 22-goal season, and before right. that he's been a middling player up and down a lot with the American Hockey League. I mean, and he's one of the main guys. Look, he's a young free agent, 27 years old, but he doesn't have a long enough proven track record to say with certainty he's going to be, you know, a top end player for the length of the deal that I think he's going to get. Because, you know, sometimes we scoff at the numbers. I think the real win for most free agents is the term, and you know, I don't know yet exactly what's going to go on with Bolesky, but I would guess he's looking for 5, 6, 7 years on his deal. And there's going to be risk there for whoever signs. I mean, there's reward potentially, too. I mean, this is it's kind of the game. But that, to me, is the biggest candidate to get a big contract and maybe not live up to it.
Are you hearing anything on Kessel or Phaneuf, Chris?
I think the Kessel thing with Pittsburgh is still a possibility. I mean, it just makes too much sense from the Penguins' perspective. I mean, they've been mentioned in the TJ Oshie and Patrick Sharp contract talks. The issue with those is that Pittsburgh needs to unload money in addition to bringing those guys in. Mm-hmm. And the teams they're largely dealing with can't really take on money. Whereas the Leafs are uniquely positioned in that they have a ton of cap space and they're willing to use it in terms of maybe taking back some oversized contracts for guys that are a little long in the tooth or, you know, mildly overpaid, whatever it may be. And I think that there is a recipe there to get this done. And it's pretty clear the Leafs are open to doing it. I mean, they want to reimagine things themselves, and if they trade Phil Kessel, no matter what the return is, that's going to be a major deal. And I still think that's possible. I haven't heard much, to be honest, from around the league on Phaneuf. I don't know where things are at there. My sense is they're comfortable starting the year with him, which isn't to say they're not with Kessel. But I think there's a little bit more interest in potentially getting a Kessel deal done specifically from the Penguins this week.
Aren't you kind of interested in seeing what Mike Babcock could do with Dion Phaneuf? I mean, I keep talking about this. I find that intriguing. I find that might be an intriguing pairing. Yeah.
Phaneuf for sure. I think the whole team, you know, last year they weren't as bad as their record. They weren't. I was around them a whole bunch. And, you know, I think in some ways, what's the saying? The inmates kind of ran the asylum. Yep. I think that there was just, you know, even some of the players on the team were venting somewhat publicly and certainly privately about some of the things going on there. I think now that there's going to be a clear hierarchy, there's going to be direction, there's going to be no BS, I think that they'll get more out of a lot of guys. And Phaneuf is a good candidate to be one of them.
Chris, we're going to let you run. You got to rest up your voice. You'll have about 35 hours of work to do tomorrow.
Lots of phone calls tonight, too.
Absolutely. Free agent frenzy tomorrow on all the Sportsnet platforms. Chris Johnson, thank you very much for joining us in studio. Joe Siddall will join us from the ballpark. Oh, we got some stuff to talk to Joe Siddall about, how he broke young Luke Wilson's
Absolutely.
Heart.
Absolutely.
I didn't know that story. Joe Siddall joined us. We're going to talk Little Blue Jays when primetime continues on the Sportsnet Radio and Television Network.